Welcome to Jesus Through Her Eyes, our class on Jesus' interactions with women in the Gospels. I'm Larissa.
And I'm Olivia Stewart Lester.
And we will be talking about this together. This week, we'll be looking at a text that's found in the three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but that we don't find in John, unlike last week. However, like last week, we'll see that this passage has a lot of layers to uncover and unfold as we look at this woman's story and also the story that surrounds it. For today, we're going to focus on Mark's version of the text, which can be found in Mark 5, verses 21 to 43. Olivia, do you want to read the start of the passage for us?
Sure. So this is Mark 5, starting in verse 21. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered round him, and he was by the lake. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue named Jairus came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So he went with him.
And a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, for she said, "If I touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease."
While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat.
Thanks, Liv. So I wonder if what's most helpful for us is to talk a little about the structure of this passage. Mm-hmm. We have two different stories going on here, and they interact with one another a little bit. Can you tell us what's going on here, why we have this structure?
Yeah, definitely. So two things. One kind of big picture in terms of the overall structure of the Gospel of Mark. Mark falls into two halves. So kind of 1:1 through 8:26, we have a description of Jesus's ministry of healing and preaching in Galilee. And then from 8:27 all the way through the end of the book, we have a kind of intensified focus on Jesus's suffering. So his the prediction of his suffering and then his death in Jerusalem. And then we end with the story of the woman at the empty tomb. Now, focusing in on this particular passage, we're switching back and forth between two stories. The kind of fancier term for this is an intercalation, but other people more colloquially might call this a Markan sandwich, where one story is inserted into the other such that there's kind of a bookend or the pieces of bread of the sandwich on the outside. Mm-hmm. So the story of Jairus' daughter is the kind of bread on the outside of the sandwich, and the story of the woman who longs to be healed is the kind of interior. And there have been a number of possible sort of reflections on how these two stories are related, and we can get into that more as we kind of talk about the passages themselves. In terms of the style and kind of texture of the Gospel of Mark, This strategy of intercalations is one hallmark. Another hallmark is Mark, among the Gospels, has a very kind of fragmentary style of prose and a real sense of urgency. So the Greek very literally will often read kind of and immediately this, and immediately this, and immediately this, kind of short, choppy phrases. Right. And we get a little bit of that feel here. The pacing picks up speed at certain moments in the text.
It's almost like every paragraph in Mark starts with and or immediately or while, right? We see that actually in this passage for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this, particular to Mark, but notably for this story as well, this urgency or this busyness of Jesus that we get. And so talking about the two passages that we have going on here, what's some of the interplay that we see? Why do these two stories combine? What do we learn from them in relationship?
Yeah, so I don't have one good answer for you. I'm going to lay out a number of options. One is I think both stories are told in a way that emphasizes the difficulty of the task of healing. And I should say that in this point and in a number of the observations I'm going to make today, I'm really informed by an excellent commentary by a scholar named Adela Yarbrough Collins, who is also one of my teachers. So I feel especially kind of beholden to name my indebtedness to her in this.
Yeah, got to give her some credit.
But she notes that both the length of the woman's illness and the kind of intensity of the child being close to death sets up these two stories as really kind of magnifying the difficulty of the task of healing. And in this way, then it kind of throws into relief the kind of reality of Jesus's divine power, that this story is one of many in kind of Mark 4:35 through 6:6 of kind of epiphanies of Jesus's divine power. Another link that I just hadn't seen, honestly, until rereading this today, is that the daughter of Jairus is 12 years old and the woman has been suffering from this irregular bleeding is what I'm going to call it for now, because there are actually some debates about if hemorrhaging is really the best way to understand what's going on. But also that's been happening for 12 years. So this child of Jairus, who's capable of getting up and walking around and eating, has been alive as long as this woman has been suffering. So that's another link that many people kind of draw attention to. And then certainly, you know, these are both women, a young woman child, but also then an adult woman who are being healed by Jesus. So as we're continuing to kind of gather up instances of interactions between Jesus and women, young and old, that's another link between the two stories.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think as we explore these passages some, we'll be drawn back into this relationship between them. Today, we're predominantly focusing on the woman who is healed, so the center story. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when we were talking about how to prep this, Olivia pushed me to include this surrounding story as well, because it illuminates so much. And as we talk about it too, we'll probably broaden at points to talk about what Mark's doing.
Yeah.
Because yeah, these stories are in relationship. Most of Scripture, and particularly the Gospels, aren't just little passages for us to take in nuggets, but are intended as a broader narrative. And so I think with this passage, we see that a bit more, how we interact with it as a story with an intent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want us to talk about this woman who is being healed. Again, like last week, an unnamed woman. So we have to refer to her kind of sideways. Both women are unnamed, but one at least her father's name. So we've got a Jairus's daughter. At least we have a way to reference her. But this woman is just the woman who is unwell. And so I think we have to talk about the thing that may make some people uncomfortable is what exactly is going on with this woman. And so if you're a little queasy talking about women's health issues, it's okay if you want to skip ahead 5 to 10 minutes, but I encourage you not to. I promise not to be too vivid. but it's necessary to comment that likely what's going on is gynecological. This is a distinctively women's health-related kind of bleeding.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, although what I didn't realize until kind of digging a little bit further into this is, ancient Greek medical texts, they have a distinctive term for hemorrhaging, and it's not the term that Mark uses.
Yeah.
So although we've read from the NRSV, which I find in general to be a really helpful translation, and it does use the word hemorrhaging, I think it's actually better to use the language that's a little more traditional of either kind of an issue of blood or a flow of blood.
Yeah.
Blood is named in the Greek, but the term that's linked with it is not the term that ancient medical texts tend to use for hemorrhaging. So what's happening here is certainly gynecological, probably menstrual, but some description of kind of continuous, disordered bleeding that has lasted for 12 years, but isn't quite at the level of 12 years of hemorrhaging.
One of the commentaries I read pointed out that hemorrhaging for 12 years would kill you.
Right.
It's certainly that translation is an overshot. But part of why I think that translation is preferred in English, or we see it in so many translations, is because if you just say a flow of blood, right, it can mm-hmm. sound less than what it is, that this is yep. not common menstruation. This isn't what many women experience every month.
Right.
This is something irregular and distressing to her body. We don't know its cause. We don't know if it's a postpartum issue or if it's trauma related or if this is something that she's, you know, we don't have bluntly know precisely how long this has happened or mm-hmm. her age. We know how long. We don't know her age, so we don't know when mm-hmm. it started. So we don't know the broader context of her disease, but we certainly know that this is irregular, that this is not a common situation for her.
That's right. And although the text doesn't talk about this, I mean, I think, you know, that you and I could imagine some of the surrounding kind of physical impact of this. I mean,
right.
Think about anemia, think about kind of low energy. You know, when I think about the physicality of a woman who has been bleeding for 12 years, pushing through a crowd to get to a Jesus who is on his way somewhere else, that gives me pause. You know, I do think
right.
we lose something of an appreciation for the fullness of this, the woman's experience, when we perhaps give in to just kind of relegating discussion about women's bodies and menstrual
uh-huh.
Cycles and bleeding kind of to things that we might be uncomfortable to think about. We miss out on a little bit of a dimension of the story, I think.
Yeah, it's coincidentally, I happened to be having a conversation with a friend who was dealing with something like this very recently, and she was saying, you know, the fatigue and that exhaustion that you feel when you're anemic, which is common when you have a large loss of blood, the consistency of that and the toll that it takes, that gets missed when we're like, yep, she's bleeding, and kind of throw it out the window for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
The length of time is painful in its own right, and
yep.
yet to understand the ramifications on her body, but also mm-hmm. on her emotionally, and
mm-hmm.
the idea of this kind of pain for that extended time, regardless of the ailment, dealing with something for 12 years, that, as the passage tells us, she's went to doctors and tried to get it solved.
Mm-hmm.
It's made her destitute and worse. She's worse now than when she started.
That the text draws our attention to the severity of this experience for the woman. In verse 29, when it says that she's been healed from her disease, the Greek term there literally is a whip or a scourge, and kind of more metaphorically is a torment, a mastix. So it's not just a kind of clinical way of talking about an ailment. It really is a very visceral term. This has been something that has been distressing to her. And, you know, to the ideas of weakness and lack of energy and anemia, mm-hmm. there might have been physical pain for the duration of this 12-year mm-hmm. period that accompanied that bleeding. We just don't know. But this is certainly a kind of significant and difficult experience that she's gone through.
Yeah, and, you know, we mentioned last week both of us have young children.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is some degree in which I have developed more sympathy for this woman postpartum,
yes.
right? This idea that, there's weakness in the body, and doing something amazing like giving birth can take a toll, right? Who knows if this is postpartum? It's kind of not the point. But the idea that, like, our bodies that are made to do something so beautiful also come with a real cost and toll. And the burden of our own physicality, I think, has drawn me back to this passage with more sympathy for her and to think about her more as a person than just a type.
Yeah, you know, I think the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that this kind of bleeding can result from postpartum. It can also result from other health problems that threaten reproductive health. And whether or not she had any children before all of this started, we're just not told. But, you know, I think the implication is during that 12-year period that she would not have been able to have other children or any children. And so that might be a whole other level of pain and challenge that she's going through, and fear, indeed.
So one commentary that I looked at today commented on that relationship back with Jairus' daughter, who is 12, which would have been a common age to move in towards motherhood at the time. And so that parallel of the death of someone about to reach their societal role as mother and a woman who, for these 12 years, is likely denied that ability. In a society in which a woman's role as mother is predominant, that the idea of a working mother or a rich and plentiful life outside of motherhood for women is limited in this context. So, yeah, I think that that piece, we can't underscore also the damage to her sense of dignity and her role in society.
Yeah, I think something that's so great about this text is that in many ways it casts this woman in the role of kind of idealized disciple in distinction to expectations about women as child bearers that she takes on in many ways much more kind of dignity in this story. And while that isn't kind of unique in the ancient world, we can think about surrounding kind of dominant expectations of women. And I think certainly childbearing would be a big one.
Yeah. So we've kind of talked about this, the intensity of her condition and what that have meant. And one of the things that's often talked about in relationship to this passage, and Liv, I want particularly to hear your perspective on this, is the question about how much purity laws play in, and the idea that she would have been ritualistically unpure because of her bleeding.
Yeah, this is a great question, because it's a little bit complicated to answer. So there are those who read this passage and would say, oh, well, the woman is obviously ritually impure. And sometimes they allied that notion of ritual impurity with kind of moral impurity. And they see Jesus as kind of completely unique in connecting with her in that impurity and including her in his movement. And while there is an element of that that is helpful, certainly there was a notion of ritual impurity in ancient Judaism. It has to be, I think, very carefully separated out from any kind of moral impurity. You could be rendered ritually impure by all kinds of things. And certainly ancient Judaism had a framework for women who menstruated or experienced vaginal discharge. So we don't need to necessarily assume that she would have been socially isolated for those reasons. We can, however, kind of see Jesus as unconcerned about any sort of notion of ritual impurity, perhaps in contrast with some groups within ancient Judaism, especially the communities that produce the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we're not, I think, on good grounds if we see Jesus as being totally unique here, but we do see a moment of connection across a dimension of ritual purity and impurity, perhaps, as long as we remain clear that there is no kind of moral valence to that, that ritual impurity was a different kind of category than moral purity or impurity.
Yeah, no, that's, I think, a helpful comparison for those of us, right, who don't have these categories at all, that it would have been common for everyone in Jewish societies to be unclean or impure at a certain point in time. And to get to what the text is saying, right, we don't have anywhere in the text that it identifies that purity or impurity is a part of the category. That doesn't mean it doesn't matter. Because we do see that question, and particularly, right, in many of Jesus' accounts, we see him interacting with people who are unclean. Mm-hmm. So certainly it's a tone that could be there, but mm-hmm. it's at least fair to say that it isn't the driving narrative of the passage, nor is it highly likely that this would have made her societally outcast.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And people have, you know, brought this idea up with respect to verse 33. So after Jesus asked who touched me, when she comes in fear. So people have asked, well, why was she afraid? And so that explanation about, oh, well, she was a social outcast because right. she was ritually impure. But there are other options. She might have been embarrassed to reveal her particular condition. She might have been afraid that she kind of somehow stole Jesus's power without his permission. Or she might just be in fear in the sense of awe at this kind of great divine power.
Yeah, it's in the RSV, it translates it fear and trembling, right? Mm. Which is we're accustomed to in the Old Testament is the response to an encounter with God. I found that really vivid to see it in that light versus like afraid of being caught. Yep. There's maybe space for both readings, but it's certainly useful to think about it in this encounter with Jesus. The way her faith or maybe limitedness of it comes into play. It was something that I found interesting, at least, is that she shows up and is looking for Jesus because, as she says, let me find it here in the passage. In verse 28, she says, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Like she's not like Jesus is the Messiah, salvation can be found in him. Therefore, I will find him, and he will then heal me. It's first, I've heard things about this miracle worker, and if I just touch him. Maybe this is the solution that I've been looking for with all these doctors. Mm-hmm. Maybe then I will feel better. And so she comes with a certain purpose in mind. And Jesus then calls her out of the crowd and calls her daughter and affirms her faith. I think for me, that's really beautiful to see is that, the way she shows up to Jesus is enough. And I think maybe that's a theme I've hit at last week too, and maybe I'll keep doing it, is this idea that how we show up to Jesus, our small amounts of faith are enough. Yeah, so that the faith that she shows up with is enough, that there isn't this need for more for her to be affirmed, or importantly for God to act. And we'll talk about that some with this interaction with her and Jesus. But I think it's almost comical again to look at the disciples as a foil, right? We have the disciples lingering in the background of the story again, and where they show up in verse 31, right? They certainly are unaware of what has happened, if not completely annoyed with Jesus when they say, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say who touched me? Like, come on, man, everybody's touching you."
Yeah.
I love to see that as a foil. Like, they once again are missing it, and yet they still are the ones who get to walk beside Jesus, and ultimately some of them the ones who get to see his resurrected body and his transfigured body. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is a particularly pronounced theme in Mark. So Mark frequently presents the disciples as uncomprehending is kind of the diplomatic mm-hmm. way to put it. they don't quite comprehend what's going on.
I call them dopey, and you call them uncomprehending.
And, you know, here I think it's a really interesting kind of case study because Matthew and Luke both describe this story as well, but they do it in slightly different ways. So Luke completely omits this conversation between Jesus and the disciples where he asked them who touched me. And then they say, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say who touched me?" Luke retains that Jesus asks the question, but has Peter just say the first half about the crowd is pressing in on you. That's to paraphrase, but that's the gist. But you know, I love there's so much that's unsaid, I think, behind that latter half of the disciple statement here. How can you say who touched me? Are they like, you are an idiot? Are they mad at him? We just don't know, but it's such a deeply human moment, I think. You know, both that Jesus asks who touched my clothes and that the disciples then have some kind of, I think, emotional reaction to it. We're not necessarily told what it is precisely, but none of the options are a kind of neutral, you know, how can you say who touched me? I think we're meant to read some kind of edge to this.
So I just watched the Framing Britney documentary, which I highly recommend. I'm like Talladega Nights last week. but part of me wonders if that's some of the disciples, right? They're traveling with the most notoriously important person. And as we're told, the crowds are pressing in on him in this scene. Right before this, he's leaving. He goes by boat to the other side, right, to get away from one large crowd that he'd been with and to get to the next. There's this constant onslaught of people who are surrounding him. And to give the disciples some credit, that fatigue of being like the bouncers for Jesus all the time. you know, they're like, come on, like, I can't keep everybody away from you. I think about that and that image, right, of someone, to compare maybe the disciples to Britney Spears a tiny bit, right, who are so overwhelmed by all of their life being something other people are engaging with. And on top of that, like, I can't get a moment of peaceness. I think maybe this week I want to give them a little more credit for that, even though it's clear, like, they're, all this to say, when I normally call them dopey, they are, but they're also humans in a kind of complicated situation.
Yeah, and, you know, there have been those who've thought about the kind of literary role of this motif in the gospel as either an invitation to the reader or a kind of consolation, you know, that the disciples function to voice questions that the audience themselves would have had or to flag moments of ambiguity. So I think that's why when I teach this theme, I tend to use the language of uncomprehending is, you know, it's not always necessarily a negative. In some ways, they become a kind of cipher for the audience. But I think what is clear is that in this story, the disciples are in some pretty stark contrast to this woman, precisely around the language of kind of faith and trust. So, you know, I said that this story occurs in a subsection that relates a number of kind of epiphanies of divine power. The first of those is in Mark chapter 4, when Jesus calms the storm. And right at the end of that chapter, he asks them in a frustrated way, have you still no faith? And this is I think it's 4:40. And, you know, the setup to this story in chapter 5, again, gestures to the boat and kind of crossing by the lake. And I think there is a little bit of a callback. You know, yes, it's a mechanism for driving the narrative forward, but it's also, I think, a callback to, oh, remember what you've just heard or read about the calming of the storm. So Jesus' reaction to the disciples is, have you still no faith? Jesus' reaction to the woman is, daughter, your faith has made you well. I mean, she's a kind of exemplary figure in this, right, I think.
So I think we should move into talking about Jesus some here. Mm-hmm. And what's going on with him? What are we learning here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we see, so building on the kind of theme of faith and belief for a moment, I think, you know, the woman is exemplary, and I think that she shows the kind of faith that Jesus is looking for in the story. Mm-hmm. So he validates this as like, yes, this is the appropriate response. And in some ways, I think she is the figure that we're meant to have in mind later on when Jesus says to the leader of the synagogue, don't fear, only believe. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, it's kind of echoing back, like, this is what belief looks like. It's this woman. So Jesus is someone looking for this kind of response. I do think, and this isn't, I don't have a good kind of pithy takeaway for this, there is a certain strangeness, or for me, kind of discomfort to some of the portrayal of Jesus in this chapter, both that kind of exchange with the disciples. You know, what does it mean to have a Jesus who experiences kind of interpersonal weirdness, for lack of a better term? And then, you know, I don't have a good explanation, frankly, for his response to those who are mourning the death of the child in verse 39, where he says, the child isn't dead but sleeping. I mean, I think it's meant to throw into relief the kind of lack of faith, perhaps, of those people who laugh at him, that he kind of casts them out and just keeps the child's parents. But it's a pretty shocking, I mean, especially as a new parent, it's a shocking and very inexplicable thing for me, frankly, to see that that's the statement Jesus gives here in response to the death of this child.
Yeah.
So there's some mystery, I think, for me regarding what we learn about Jesus in those encounters.
Yeah. I think about that, right? And he gets there and he writes them off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a lot of contours of how we can process that, right? Is he making a statement about ultimate truth there, right? Like sleeping in the sense that she will be alive again? And is he just trying to end their mourning, right? Because they're mourning in vain in some sense. Mm-hmm. But it is complicated. Yeah. But that's his response. And I think in a couple of weeks, when we get to that passage after Lazarus's death, it's telling his difference there, the way that he interacts with Mary and Martha, mm-hmm. and his response. So I kind of just want to put a pin in that in some ways to say, like, let's come back to this Jesus and the way that he responds and the distinction when he's interacting with different people.
Yeah. The only other thing I might add about that here, so I don't feel like I have great clarity about Jesus's response in verse 39, but it might be worth just talking about his response in 43 in case it's related. So in 43, he orders them that no one should know this. And this is also a real kind of Markan motif. So in the history of New Testament interpretation, this has been known as the Messianic secret. And this is refers to moments where Jesus prohibits either demons that he has just cast out who want to reveal who he is, or tells people that they shouldn't kind of make his identity known after he's healed them. In this case, it's slightly different because the thing he is commanding secrecy about is the resurrection itself. It's not himself. He says he orders them that no one should know this, not that no one should know who he is.
Yeah.
But I will just sort of summarize a very complex discussion by saying that this motif has been a real site of interest for people, in interest in kind of constructing the historical Jesus. They've had a hard time kind of understanding why would someone who thought that he was the Messiah command this kind of secrecy. And to oversimplify a really large conversation, one possible explanation for this is that Jesus lived during a very politically tumultuous time, and to claim some kind of identity as Messiah often had a political valence to it. And we know now in hindsight that Jesus died by crucifixion, which was a Roman method of execution. And so it might be that Jesus was trying to kind of minimize the political turmoil around him in the early stages of his ministry. That's one kind of viable explanation for this motif. And although it doesn't really help us, I don't think, understand his statement that, you know, the child isn't dead but sleeping, I think it might give us some explanation for why he kind of commanded all the mourners to leave. That he's not looking, it seems, to publicize what he's doing yet.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of related to something I want us to spend some time talking about, back to the woman who is healed. Is the sense in which, so I have this narrative that I don't know where I've constructed it, that miracles are a proof of Jesus' divinity. Therefore, miracles exist to convince me when I'm doubting, or as an evangelistic tool.
Mm.
And bluntly, it's not what we see here. Her faith is a component. What we see in the passage following this, when Jesus goes to Nazareth, he is unable to do only a handful of healings because of the lack of faith in the community where he grew up, right? There's this interesting dynamic that's happening where Jesus' ability to heal, part of his divinity here, is limited or bounded by the faith of those who participate or in the community. This, I put in my notes, somewhat heretically, I think, that there's a little Tinkerbelly kind of quantity, right? That faith propels him forward. It enables him to function. And so with that in mind, I think it's really interesting to look at the sequencing of events in Mark, and it is a little different in Matthew and Luke, and I think that bears noting, she touches him and is immediately healed, and then mm-hmm. Jesus is like, I feel something happened. As it says in verse 30, immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, right? That's when he asks, who touches me?
Yeah.
So there's this question, right, about how, unlike other healing narratives in which Jesus sets out to heal someone and heals them, even as what we see, right, in Jairus' daughter's account mm-hmm. surrounding this, Jesus seems almost passive in this instant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's a kind of provocative reading that the woman in some ways kind of claims healing for herself from Jesus without him being aware at all. I do think she deserves a lot of credit here for her faith and for her agency and for her kind of active pursuit. Even I've already referenced the kind of physicality of that. And I think that there are a number of parallels, interestingly, between Jesus and the woman. So I was struck on a rereading of this that she knows in her body that she's been healed. So this is in verse 29. Her hemorrhage or her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And then in verse 30, Jesus knows more literally kind of in himself. So it doesn't in the Greek say in his body. It's not an exact parallel, but Jesus knows within himself in the way that the woman knows in her body that she's been healed. Mm. And, you know, while she has a response of fear when Jesus asks the question, I don't think there's any kind of lack of faith on her part. I really do think that she's a kind of exemplary figure. And I think that in many ways, the blend of her kind of physicality and her faith give us a window into both what the text is calling for in terms of like ideal responses to Jesus, but also perhaps we can think about some fruitful connections between the woman herself and Jesus. You know, I think as you've so helpfully posed that question about what kind of Jesus do we see here, we see, again, if we take the incarnation seriously, a Jesus who knows things in a bodily way now in the course of his human life. And we see a Jesus whose body is like every other human body and courses with blood. And we'll sort of think, you know, as we move through Lent, we'll think together about the very real physicality of Jesus's death, so that this is a woman of flesh and blood who helps us kind of think about a Jesus of flesh and blood.
Yeah.
And I think that's important, particularly in a kind of, you know, intellectual history in the ancient world that some strands associated, you know, men with this kind of ideal disembodied intellect, sort of soul, ideal mind, and women with the kind of fleshy physicality of the earth. And I'm not predominantly here actually thinking about ancient Jewish attitudes of gender at all. I'm thinking about like Plato and Aristotle, you know, who associate women with kind of lower realms of existence.
Yeah.
I think there's an important parallel perhaps here between this woman and Jesus, particularly, you know, I meant to talk about this earlier, the woman spent all the money that she'd had. So she at this point is somewhat kind of in financial trouble. But that meant that she was initially someone of significant enough wealth to spend everything that she had on doctors. I mean, that's not a kind of position of weakness.
There's not a government-sponsored healthcare, right, in the ancient Eastern world. So doctors are a privilege. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And so I think that's a helpful note that her going to visit doctors isn't easy or accessible, even in the sense that, like, our complicated system in the U.S. is not even in the sense that you and I can go to the doctor somewhat easily, even if it's costly.
Yeah.
It would have been vastly prohibitive to most people.
Yeah.
I think that's a useful aside, but I want to think back a little to just some of these comments about doing this during Lent and thinking about the incarnation and this bodily Jesus. Yeah, I think it's a really useful reminder for us. It's easy for us to kind of fall into that Gnostic tendency of Jesus is the spirit that floats through, right? Mm-hmm. Which we have a little tiny bit of post-resurrection, right? He goes through doors. although he's bodily. He's got those holes in his hands, right? So there's some transcendent bodiness mm-hmm. there. But all of that is aside to say the idea of Jesus as human is a really useful meditation. And is, I think, countercultural both to us and to the original audience of these texts. Like you mentioned, right, mm-hmm. this early Greek notion to the non-Jewish readers of this text. In particular, they would have been heavily in that Greek philosophy. And it's been a bit since I've taught philosophy. But there is this, I'm hoping I'm getting this right, this image of a chariot. And the mm-hmm. idea is that our souls are moving us upwards toward mm-hmm. the world of form, towards this spiritual intellectual world.
Yes.
But we are being dragged down by our physical nature. And so mm-hmm. the best of us lift their way out of this rough, terrible bodily existence
yes.
into a proper spiritual life, right? So mm-hmm. I think our culture actually consumes a good amount of that. We are bodily in different ways, but we have this sense that ourselves is somehow separated from our physical flesh. There's this body hacking thing mm-hmm. that I think Silicon Valley types are into, right? This idea, like, I'll freeze my brain and then I'll get to live again in another 100 years. To miss that Jesus isn't that. I think, yeah, it's important to see him as a person with a body, and that is deeply, deeply important to our understanding of the way that he cares for us and interacts with us and understands us.
Yeah. Yeah. The only other thing I did want to say is that for me, learning more about disability studies has added another level of how I interpret this text. And it relates in part to this idea of Jesus as a real kind of physically human person. It also relates to the connection that you said, Larissa, between the way this particular healing story attributes healing to the woman having faith. And I think I have found it very helpful to separate out the kinds of claims that the text is making about Jesus's divine power being realized through healing. And then as we think about the ongoing use of scripture in our kind of present moment, remembering, and this is what I've learned from disability criticism, remembering that there are people who live with disabilities in ongoing mm-hmm. ways, and that we have to interpret these texts in ways that give them full dignity as well. And one of the insights that has been most powerful for me from disability scholars is the reminder that, as you said, that the resurrected body of Jesus still bears scars from the crucifixion, that the resurrected body, and this is what theologian Nancy Iceland claims, in Jesus, God experiences disability, that what we see in the resurrected body of Jesus is a disabled body. And so, you know, who is this Jesus? This is a Jesus of flesh and blood who dies as at the hand of a kind of execution system from an imperial state. But this is also a Jesus whose body continues to bear the marks of that execution and experiences disability very, very intimately. And so I think especially with a text like this that speaks to so many really intimate and painful challenges that women experience related to reproductive health, related to having or not having children, that it's so important to kind of to handle this story with care and not just interpret it in a way of kind of, oh, Jesus just fixes everything. That actually there are levels to this woman that go well beyond the question of whether or not she has children. And there are levels to Jesus here that go well beyond just kind of getting rid of physical impairment, that there's much more to the story here for both of those characters.
Yeah, it can be difficult when we read healing texts, and they're important because they point something to Jesus, mm-hmm. to then interpret that Jesus heals all of us rather than to say he let her be ill for 12 years, right? Mm-hmm. That's the story of God's plan for her life included those 12 years. Mm. And when we look at Jairus' daughter, his plan lets her be very ill and it lets her die before he steps in. And then we have other accounts, right, as Paul talks about this thorn in his flesh, which many speculate is a disability or some limitation of his body that he continues to bear. That there, I think we have to be careful readers and careful mm-hmm. commentators on scripture not to presume individual instances of healing means everyone. Mm-hmm. If they have faith like this woman, faith like Jairus has, mm-hmm. will be able to receive this healing, that our life is somehow incomplete mm-hmm. when we have an uncomfortable reality, whether that be physical liability like this woman, or some other context or circumstance that we bear, mm-hmm. right? Before we started recording, Liv and I were talking about just kind of hard weeks we had, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's February is miserable. February in a pandemic is more miserable. And then combine that with just complicated life. On this very long tangent, I guess what I need to hear from this text is that Jesus comes alongside us and doesn't say, I get rid of those things for you. Mm-hmm. But that there is learning in that process and healing comes, but it is far more complex. It's not just one note. Mm-hmm. So I was struck by, in verse 34, when he says to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. The tense there in particular was of note to me. This idea that she's already been healed. We're told that happened immediately. She felt it in her body. Jesus felt it. And yet she is declared... she's declared to be healed in not that you have been healed. And I wondered, there are two things I really wondered as I read that. The first was that there was some ongoing healing to be done. We talked about the sense that what she's experiencing is not isolated to this physical piece or narrowly to the bleeding, that it would have had much larger repercussions to her emotional life, her social life, her finances, mm-hmm. To her body itself. And I wonder if that's some of what this go and be healed is, that that stopping the bleeding only solves one small piece of the mess that has been made from her bleeding. And that continuation, that she's being called to live unto that and to pursue that process of healing. And the other thing it struck me is that this is in somewhat in contrast to what we're seeing at the end of this passage with Jairus' daughter being raised, is that this is declared in the crowd and among all of these people.
Yeah.
And that this declaration is important for other people to hear as well, that her faith has not made her well and that she should continue to be healed.
Yeah. Yeah, the only thing I would add is that point that I made about in verse 29, where she's healed from her disease, and we could also read that as her torment. It's the same word here. Jesus says, be healed from your torment. And I think you're right that there is an element of, there's a process to that recovery, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm jumping ahead here to also say that when... Yeah, like one of my questions when I read a text is always, who do I identify with? Who am I in the story? And reading it from those different angles and benefiting from that reading. And when I think about reading it from her angle, I do think about that for ourselves. What is it that, how do we participate in that ongoing healing? Where is it that, that God has made us well, but there is more work to be done in how we engage in it? And I think that's a helpful question when we read this. Where are we feeling like this woman where God has made things right and yet we're still dealing with the ramifications or the ongoing healing from these problems?
Mm-hmm. I think that really helps and kind of works against an overly simplistic reading of this, that it is about so much more than just stopping the bleeding, although that is a significant claim that this text is making, that the full depths of it, there's a lot more to be said about this, for sure.
Yeah. So we've already started that transition, so I think it makes sense for us to spend some time thinking about what we gain in this passage and our understanding of how Jesus cares for us. Was there something in particular that stood out to you in your reading of this passage?
Yeah, I do think I keep, in each passage we've been discussing together, thinking about what these different women say about the incarnation as kind of exemplary figures of faith. So the Samaritan woman as a kind of idealized witness, but also a witness that gives us a window into a Jesus who is tired and thirsty. And to claim that God experiences exhaustion and thirst is a very powerful thought for me. I think similarly here, the woman's kind of pushing through so much now poverty and weakness to stand as an exemplary kind of figure of faith also throws into relief the poverty that Jesus takes on. You know, I'm thinking about Philippians 2, the kind of self-emptying of Jesus. And then the kind of physicality of this woman's encounter with Jesus, pushing through crowds, experiencing in her body the drying up of this blood. I mean, the text is very visceral. That also speaks, I think, to the kind of visceral realities of the end of Jesus's life, and not in a way that we glorify the violence of that by any stretch, but that we kind of take in, as we continue through Lent, the full extent of the mystery that God incarnate would die that way, in a kind of state-sanctioned, incredibly violent way, I think speaks to Jesus's presence with people who experience life as so precarious, people who experience state violence. Jesus kind of takes in the full extent of the worst things that humanity is capable of. And I think in many ways, the flow of blood of this woman, to kind of think theologically for a moment, gestures towards that. I don't think necessarily that's a parallel that this text is setting up kind of on the face of it, but we in this liturgical season, I think, can make that link between the woman's flow of blood and the kind of flow of blood from Jesus on the cross. And just think about the ways that these women give us insights into a Jesus who cares for us in those kinds of ways.
Yeah, as an aside of sorts, reading this passage during Lent, right, draws some of those things out. The sandwich story also has these allusions that we can read towards towards the cross and towards the resurrection. Both the visceralness of it and this death and, in her case, a resuscitation, but in Jesus' case, a resurrection that, I think, draws us towards the Holy Week story as well. Reading this passage, one of the things that I am always struck by is that Jesus is busy in this passage. Last week we talked about tired Jesus, and maybe we can also relate to busy Jesus in a way. He's running from thing to thing. He's got people surrounding him, longing to be taught and to be healed. We already know that he's on task to head to Jairus' house to heal his daughter, and yet he stops. He stops to heal this woman or to engage with this woman that he's been healed. I think is a really good reminder for me that Jesus is willing to stop in that busyness for the things that are important. That he's not like, sorry, lady, I've got other things to do. Your healing is enough. But he wants to stop and complete that story, not just to heal her body, but to also connect with her. And I think both to hear that for myself, that Jesus is never too busy for me and my problems. The idea in Bible school, when we prayed for one another, one of the things that we often said is like, there's no issue too small to come to Jesus for, and our example was always a bad hair day is worthy of prayer. But that idea, right, that whatever is causing you, to separate from the things that you should be doing or is getting in the way of your faith or just, you know, your functioning like a bad hair day can do. Jesus is never too busy to hear the things that are concerning to you. You don't have to wait until you have the big prayer request to ask for prayer. And I think that's a helpful reminder in my own prayer life that, that there are big things I can pray about, but that's not all God wants me to come to him about. Mm-hmm. But also in an interpersonal way, to also be like Jesus in that way, to model after our Savior who is never too busy to see what is important, and for me to then pray that I can, like him, see what is important amid all of the urgent.
I think that really takes us back nicely to verse 33 and to one kind of final way in which the woman is exemplary, and I think we can see an evidence of Jesus's care as well, that, you know, after she responds in fear, the woman falls down before him and tells him the whole truth. And what an act of bravery that is on her part, that she doesn't dissemble, she doesn't pretend. You know, the sermon today referenced David's just repeated ability to kind of lie off the cuff, right, without a second thought. And that's not what this woman does. In a very uncomfortable moment, she just tells the whole truth. And it's that Jesus is responding to when he says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well." So his willingness to hear that whole truth as well.
Yeah. So I think we're running out of time. And so I think that might be a wrap on this text. But I want to say a couple closing notes, both to connect us to next week and to our discussion that will take place on February 28th at 12:30. We will discuss this text in last week's about the Samaritan woman in John 4 at 12:30 p.m. On February 28th. So we'll do that via Zoom. If you haven't yet found that Zoom link, you can find it on the event page of our website under Jesus Through Her Eyes, most likely where you also found this audio file. But you can find the link there to join us, and I hope you do. I'm excited to broaden our conversation and share it with you as well. And then the next class that we'll be doing will be the first of our 2 weeks on Mary and Martha. We'll cover them in tandem because their stories are together as well. And so we will look next week at the more famous passage, the one where Mary is sitting at the feet of Jesus and Martha is in the kitchen. And Liv, I think you've suggested that maybe you're with me on this one, but I think it's worthwhile to know that I have long been a Martha apologist. Mm-hmm. So you will get a little of that taste of how I try to redeem Martha in the story, because I think she deserves it. But also, as I've been reading it over these last few weeks, I'm actually starting to appreciate Mary and identify with her more. And I don't know how I feel about my own movement in that way. But I hope you'll join us for these next 2 weeks as we look at these two women and their stories and encounters with Jesus.